time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. So Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy. You can write things down like places to go and things to do and places to donate to and web pages to check out, all that kind of stuff. There's a Redwood Coast Rendezvous planned. Come on out to the mountains of Humboldt County for this year's Redwood Coast Rendezvous. And that's taking place next weekend, June 14th through the 18th. This summer looks like a hot one for direct action against extraction across the continent. Consequently, Humboldt Earth First will be focusing on skill sharing and training in order to spread the knowledge of practical blockading techniques, technical rope climbing and more direct action techniques, and campaign organizing and more direct action techniques. There's a couple of ongoing direct action campaigns in the North Coast in Willits. The Little Lake Valley Defenders have their tree sits going up and down, and they're trying to block the planned destruction for the new Highway 101 bypass around town and through ancient trees and wetlands. And out in northern Humboldt, tree sitters are holding strong in some of the oldest and largest redwoods in the Trinidad area as green diamond logs and logs and logs. Go to the following website for the location and details of the Redwood Coast Rendezvous, June 14th through 18th. That is www.efhumboldt.org. That's efhumboldt.org. And coming up on July is the 2013 Earth First Round River Rendezvous. It's going to be taking place in North Carolina, July 1st through the 8th. It's the annual gathering of the Earth First Movement. This week-long campout attracts several hundred Earth Firsters from around the world. The gathering is coordinated by a volunteer committee. I've been on that. And there's workshops, campaign discussions, campfires, campfire music, ranters, ravers, and maybe even a rally with performers and speakers. Don't forget the workshops, even though you don't like work and you don't want to shop. Perhaps the most important part of the Round River Rendezvous is the informal networking that goes on. These gatherings are particularly important for developing a cohesive activist network and planning actions on the local level. Croatan Earth First will be hosting this summer's rendezvous in central North Carolina. The exact location will be announced a little later on this month. They're choosing a spot with swimming holes and beautiful woods to hike in. They'll have earth skills, plant mushroom identification, eco-spirituality workshops, as well as medic trainings that you have to sign up for in advance. Okay? Don't show up thinking you're going to get into the medic training. No, you got to send your email in, and I'm going to give that information to you. They're also looking for new folks to host new workshops and to submit ideas for workshops and panels they'd like to see. They need money, so consider donating to WePay. If you want to contact the rendezvous, their email address is cef@riseup.net. That's cef@riseup.net. Or you could try croatanearthfirst@gmail.com, croatanearthfirst@gmail.com, croatanearthfirst. And if you want to see all the information about the rendezvous, including a tentative schedule, statements about anti-oppression, and other guidelines, go to 2013summerrondi.wordpress.com. That's 2013summerrondi.wordpress.com. Here in California, suspected bear poachers are facing charges in El Dorado County Court. Two men arrested on suspicion of unlawfully killing bear and possession of bear parts for sale were arraigned in El Dorado County Superior Court on June 4th. California Department of Fish and Wildlife officers arrested Peter George Vitale of Pioneer, California, and Arthur Martin Blake of River Pines in the El Dorado National Forest on April 20th after finding them in possession of 20 large bear claws and 3 bear gallbladders. At the time of their arrest, bear season was closed in California. Evidence developed during the investigations suggests that the suspects recently killed the 3 bears, likely a sow and their 2 cubs. The investigation determined that the claws, liver, and gallbladder were removed from the sow, and only the liver and gallbladder were removed from the other 2 bears. Bile contained inside bear gallbladders is believed by some to have medicinal properties and is sold on the black market. Bear claws and other bear parts are also unlawfully sold in California. Under California Fish and Game laws, it is a felony offense to sell, purchase, or possess for sale any bear parts. Under California law, possession of more than one bear gallbladder is prima facie evidence that the bear gallbladders are possessed for sale. If you want more information about this, go to www.dfg.ca.gov. That's dfg.ca.gov. And scientists are searching for clues about a disease outbreak in bighorn sheep. A National Park Service employee who was inspecting wildlife guzzlers found four desert bighorn sheep dead on Old Dad Mountain, 15 miles southeast of Baker, California, during the week of May 20th. The employee also observed other sick animals that appeared to be weak and unsteady with labored breathing. Laboratory analysis of the blood and tissue samples taken from one animal indicates that it has pneumonia. This disease may be acquired in desert bighorn populations from domestic sheep or goats and is usually fatal to bighorn sheep. Biologists from the National Park Service and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are conducting a field survey to determine the scope of this wildlife disease outbreak. Using volunteers from the Society for the Conservation of Bighorn Sheep and the Sierra Club to expand their capacity, biologists are visiting springs and guzzlers where bighorn congregate on Old Dad Mountain and in nearby areas to determine the extent and seriousness of the problem. While we do not yet know the full extent of this disease and event, we are taking this situation seriously. Bighorn sheep are highly susceptible to pneumonia, said Ben Gonzalez, senior wildlife veterinarian with CDFW's Wildlife Investigations Laboratory. Scientists believe there are 200 to 300 desert bighorn sheep in this particular population. The herd of desert bighorn sheep in the Old Dad Mountain area is one of the largest native populations in the Mojave Desert, said Mojave National Preserve Superintendent Stephanie Dubois. Scientists from the National Park Service and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are working together to learn all they can about this disease outbreak so we can do everything possible to reduce its impact. Once again, for more information, go to www.dfg.ca.gov. That's dfg.ca.gov. And the British Columbia government has rejected a tar sands pipeline. Ecological Internet is enormously pleased to note British Columbia, Canada's thumbs down on the proposed Northern Gateway tar sand pipelines. Announced recently, the decision virtually guarantees that the flow of filthy tar sands oil from Canada's interior to China will not commence through a western route anytime soon. Ecological Internet was the first to protest internationally on the issue, doing so since 2010, over a full year earlier than other global affinity efforts, successfully laying the groundwork for the victory. Ecological Internet's president, Dr. Glenn Berry, states, "The BC pipeline victory against tar sands ecocide is the result of innumerable instances of valor by Indigenous, local, and global tar sands protesters. Yet it is also, again, clearly demonstrates Ecological Internet and online colleagues' ability to be at the vanguard of the environmental protest, helping mobilize online large global coalitions that are ultimately successful. This is a stunning victory for Indigenous, local, and global people power and illustrates the importance of finding and funding small ecological opposition groups and taking strong biocentric positions against environmental risk." Urging a Canadian federal review panel to reject the $6 billion plan, the province of British Columbia noted the lack of a cleanup plan for inevitable spills and the many unknowns about how highly corrosive bitumen behaved after spills, particularly in water. The pipeline would have crossed remote and extremely difficult terrain through pristine rivers, temperate rainforests, and marine environments that would be devastated in the event of a spill. The province's opposition has probably doomed the pipeline, or at least it will tie it up in endless litigation. The Northern Gateway project, composed of two separate pipelines, would extend about 700 miles from the Alberta tar sands to a tanker port. That's a newly constructed tanker port on the northern coast of British Columbia. It would have the capacity to ship more than 525,000 barrels of oil per day. The rejection of the pipelines, which were to have given Alberta an outlet to Pacific Coast ports and markets in China, further raises the stakes on another controversial tar sands pipeline, the Keystone XL. Dr. Berry noted, the reasons given in rejecting the Pacific Tar Sands pipeline are just as valid for the Keystone XL and provide President Obama with marvelous opportunity to reject the new generation of toxic fossil fuel addiction that will gravely intensify abrupt climate change. Global ecological sustainability requires urgent cutting of greenhouse gas emissions through keeping tar sands and coal in the ground and protecting and restoring old-growth forests. We need to work together for all such policies simultaneously and not over-focus on one element of the battle, or we face global ecosystem collapse. The Enbridge Northern Gateway project, as proposed, included a twin pipeline system between Edmonton, Alberta, and the new marine terminal in Kitimat, British Columbia, which would carry tar sands oil by pipeline across British Columbia to be loaded onto supertankers at an ocean terminal and then shipped onward to Asia. Canadian tar sands production would have been able to expand by 30%, escalating the terrible ecological impacts upon Canadian boreal forests and its water, carbon, and ecosystems. The pipelines would go through British Columbia's sensitive Pacific North Coast ecosystem and threatens First Nations land and salmon recovery. One mishap, such as project developer Enbridge's broken pipelines fouling the Yellowstone and the Kalamazoo rivers, would bring disastrous results and long-term loss of marine life, pristine waterways, and sensitive coastal ecosystems. All along, First Nation opposition has been strong and united, making clear the pipeline would never be allowed on their land and with suggestions of massive civil obedience if approved. The pipelines cannot be constructed without breaking First Nation unity through financial inducements or simply seizing their land. And we got this story from the Ecological Internet at www.ecologicalinternet.org. And at the same time, we picked up this story at unitedfirstnations.org. British Columbia government's sneaky non-rejection of Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. Environmentalists across the country rejoiced at the news, as we just read, that the British Columbia government formally opposed the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. But, reading the 99-page submission, it becomes clear that the door for the controversial oil sands pipeline remains wide open. I've just read the British Columbia government's May 31st written submission to the Joint Review Panel established by the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency and the National Energy Board. Christy Clark, I believe, is the governor of British Columbia, no more rejects the Northern Gateway than a mother rejects her firstborn child. In fact, the analogy is rather precise. Mothers admonish their children all the time for unacceptable or socially outrageous behavior. They don't disown them or send them off to live with another family, and it is rare, thankfully, that they kill them. So it's fair to say that Christy Clark sees herself as the Northern Gateway Pipeline's mother. She's acting in political terms like she's angry and upset because her child has been behaving in a very disruptive and persistently foolish manner. But the pipeline is still her baby. So she's presenting herself like a wealthy mother fiercely admonishing, say, her child's nanny. She's talking tough about the nanny, but she's never going to abandon her child. On the other hand, what her lawyers do in spades in their 99-page written submission is reject the brainless behavior and pronouncements of the project's proponents, Enbridge Incorporated. They dissect in some detail the fantastical pie-in-the-sky proposals Enbridge has been making for building this dangerous piece of infrastructure, without, by the way, mentioning that atrocious video cartoon that removed all the islands from Kitimat's ocean access. But never forget who we're dealing with. The precise wording in any public document from governments and from the corporate sector, and most particularly from the British Columbia Liberal government and from Stephen Harper's government too, is critically important. Words are often used as stealth weapons by both governments. Nowhere, not once, does this document say, quote, "We recommend against building this pipeline," period, quote. Nor does it say, "The environmental threats posed by this project are too significant for the pipeline to succeed," or, "So it should not, in our opinion, be built." Instead, the legal minds in Christy Clark's employ have crafted a document that indirectly and repeatedly leaves the door open for development. Here's a typical example. Quote, in this particular case, the province submits that Northern Gateway should be able to show in advance of certification that it will be in a position, once operations commence, to live up to its spill response assertions. Northern Gateway has not yet done so. The province submits that the JRP should, in making its recommendations, give this factor significant consideration. Section 114, page 35. The words dance gingerly away from recommending against the controversial pipeline project. Instead, they hint at a set of conditions entirely consistent with the project going forward. That famous line, once operations commence. Then they give the panel the most insipid of directives. Quote, the JRP should give this factor significant consideration, allowing Premier Clark's close political ally, Prime Minister Harper, all the wiggle room he needs to move ahead with construction. And I had to edit this article. It goes on for quite some length and in quite some detail about all the various places within the document the British Columbia government submitted that are just, it's just really, it's legalese. And if you want to read the whole thing, go to www.unitedfirstnations.org. That's unitedfirstnations.org. And let's turn to the Center for Biological Diversity for some biological diversity news. The California State's Wolf Management Plan could set the tone for the United States. Or maybe they're talking about Oregon. Nope, California. In this story by Amarok Weiss. During the 15 months the wolf known as OR7 has crisscrossed the Oregon-California border, the news from his birthplace back in eastern Oregon has shaken the boots off of some of those holding most tightly to deeply rooted misconceptions about the ability to wolves to coexist on the landscape with the rest of us. In the 2 years since a lawsuit stopped the state of Oregon from killing wolves, the state's fledgling wolf population has doubled by nearly 50. Yet in Wallawa County, where the majority of Oregon's wolf-livestock conflicts are reported each year, fatal wolf attacks on livestock had fallen 60% as ranchers and agencies were forced to rely on non-lethal conflict prevention methods. At the same time, in neighboring Idaho, where over the last 2 years, hunters, trappers, and state agents have killed more than 700 wolves, the number of sheep and cattle killed by wolves have increased by more than 75%. In fact, those trends reflect exactly what biologists and wolf experts have been telling anyone who would listen since wolves became one of the first animals to be protected by the Endangered Species Act when it was passed 40 years ago. Tried and true, centuries-old, non-lethal wolf management techniques such as range riding, livestock guarding dogs, and appropriate fencing greatly reduce predation by wolves on livestock. And it reinforces the fact that killing wolves and leaving behind orphaned pups and dispersed packs actually increases the chances of livestock being killed, because once the order of the pack is destroyed, so is its natural pack discipline of teaching younger wolves to kill natural prey such as deer and elk, leaving lone wolves no choice but to take down the easiest prey they can to survive. Those lessons come at a valuable time for Californians during the current public comment period, which ended in May, on whether we should protect wolves under the State Endangered Species Act. It reminds us that as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service moves towards dropping federal protection for wolves in the lower 48 states, we have a great opportunity to build a wolf management plan that sets a national example of how wolves can coexist with human endeavors. Wolf experts have long said California has hundreds of thousands of acres of excellent wolf habitat. Of course, California is also the nation's most populated state and home to a thriving livestock industry of more than 6 million cattle and sheep. With 163,000 square miles, California is the nation's third largest state, behind only Alaska and Texas. And that means we're in a great position to share the land we've inherited with the species we purposely killed off in California and in many other western states. The return of wolves to California is a promising event for many of us, unfortunate enough to make our home here in the Bear Republic, where the state flag, featuring an image of the state's last known grizzly, says a lot about how we see ourselves. Like residents of the other 49 states, we too are concerned about jobs, taxes, education, climate change, and the length of our commutes. But the people who make up our state's ever-swelling population continue to represent Western ideals as old as the state, from an ongoing pioneer-style willingness to go where others have not, to a belief in fresh starts, even for wolves. The arrival of OR7 in California in December of 2011 shows it's only a matter of time before wolves once again make their homes in our state. And given that animals live in ecosystems rather than states, whether OR7 decides to put down roots here is only a side issue in a much larger ecological evolution, one that wolf experts say will surely result in wolves returning permanently to California. They're coming. The question is, will we be ready to protect them? Efforts to make sure those protections are in place were put in motion last fall when state officials recommended that California extend endangered species protections to OR7 and all that follow him. That recommendation will be ruled on in October. In the meantime, let's be clear. Recovering wolves to their historic range will take discipline and the acceptance that they, like the rest of us, have a right to be here. It won't always be easy, but as the mounting evidence from neighboring Oregon shows, it can be done, and if done well, if we're willing. And tree-dwelling seabirds are surviving timber industry attacks. Marble murrelets threaten seabirds that nest in coastal old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest kept their protections in Washington, D.C., when a court ruled not to eliminate their federally protected critical habitat and remove Endangered Species Act protections that they've had since 1992. The judge ruled in a lawsuit spurred by a proposal by the timber industry to remove protections, the industry's third try in the past decade to toss out murrelet protections so it can increase logging of forests more than 100 years old. This despite undisputed scientific evidence that murrelets are disappearing from the coasts of Washington, Oregon, and California. The Center for Biological Diversity has been fighting to protect murrelets since 2005, and we were one of several environmental groups defending the murrelet in this latest timber industry case. This industry assault ignores the biological reality that murrelets in our region continue to struggle to survive, said the Center's Endangered Species Director, Nora Greenwald. Without old-growth forest protection, these beautiful birds will disappear from our coasts. And here's news from the wild and weird. The next time your crazy uncle comes back from his seaside vacation ranting about being tracked by a 6-foot jellyfish with a camera for an eye and a bundle of wires and electrodes wrapped under its bell, don't be so quick to chalk it up to sun-baked paranoia. A partnership between the U.S. Navy and Virginia Tech College of Engineering has, in fact, developed such a creature, a military robot jellyfish drone. So far, it's only a prototype. This sci-fi replica of one of the Earth's oldest brainless animals has its own 600-gallon swimming pool. The Navy hopes that one day a fleet of these cyber gelatinoids will help keep Americans safe, at least until the enemies of freedom dispatch their own legions of pygmy seahorse attack drones. And 55,000 people want Alabama's Rattlesnake Rodeo to become a wildlife festival. Right before an annual rattlesnake rodeo in Op, Alabama, recently, the Center for Biological Diversity presented a 55,000-signature petition asking the city to replace the rattlesnake rodeo with a wildlife-friendly festival where no snakes are killed. The city of Op and Wiggum, Georgia, hosts the only two remaining lethal rattlesnake roundups in the southeast. Last year, Claxton, Georgia, replaced its roundup with a non-lethal rattlesnake and wildlife festival. In 2011, the center and allies filed a petition to protect eastern diamondbacks under the Endangered Species Act. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has begun a full status review to figure out whether to give the snakes protection. The eastern diamondbacks, targeted by the Op Rattlesnake Rodeo, are rapidly disappearing all across the southeastern United States, said the center's snake specialist Colette Atkins-Geis. I hope this will be the last time rattlers are collected for the Op Rattlesnake Rodeo. There's no reason to kill these rare animals. Most people attending the Op event just want to see some amazing snakes and have a fun day. And here's some more news from the wild and weird. Tourist-fed stingrays turn lazy. According to a recent study, tourist interaction with stingrays at one of the world's most visited ecotourism destinations has caused the cartilaginous fishes to become more sedentary and aggressive than their wilder counterparts. It's even altered their mating habits. Ecotourist companies at Stingray City, a series of sandbars in the Cayman Islands, promise an interactive experience with marine wildlife, drawing more than 1 million visitors per year. Tourists arrive ready to feed, pet, and swim with stingrays. A single stingray equates to about $500,000 a year in tourism income for the islands. But a team of researchers from Nova Southeastern University in Florida and the University of Rhode Island have concluded that close human contact and daily feedings along Stingray City have transformed stingray behavior. These formerly solitary nocturnal hunters, which travel great distances, have become homebodies and daytime feeders that crowd in groups of more than 100 and spend their days within a quarter of a square mile. Plus, stingrays near the eco resort exhibit signs of unusual aggression, biting each other more often than normal, and have abandoned their usual mating season for mating year-round. Yeah, I had one more I wanted to read here. Deadly disease hits home of biggest U.S. gray bat colony. White nose syndrome has now been found in northern Alabama's Fern Cave, the world's largest colony of wintering endangered gray bats. It's also home to about 1 million endangered Indiana bats. The disease has already killed nearly 7 million of the planet's only true flying mammals since it was first discovered in North America in 2006. It has spread to 22 U.S. states and 5 Canadian provinces. In announcing the startling discovery, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said the largest white-nosed cases were extremely alarming and could be catastrophic. The Center for Biological Diversity has pushed for a nationwide plan to stem the spread of the disease, including limiting human access to public lands, caves, to emergency and research-related uses. With this one cave containing more than a third of the world's gray bats, all the alarm bells should be going off, said Molly Madison, our bat specialist. White nose syndrome is now threatening the very survival of the gray bat and several other species. And for more information about all that, you can go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. That's www.biologicaldiversity.org. And that's all the time we have this week for the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every week here at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 9 o'clock on Thursday nights. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, tune in on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio. Or you can tune, if you're in Moscow, Idaho, to Radio KRFP 92.5 FM on Monday nights at 9:30 to hear the Earth First Update. If you aren't near one of those, you can always download the Earth First Update from radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, for all. .net. All right. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We'd like to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.